session number 10687, reel 6.
Mr. Quill, reel 6.
Stornoway House in London, and it was rather, there were a lot of other people there, including, I remember, that chap who was the Minister of Information at the time. But we never, in fact, we had a very good dinner, of course, and it was a nice, interesting evening, but we never got around, there would be a book to the subject of cannons, and the next morning I had to go off back to Rochford, and so it was a rather non-event from the point of view of cannons and Spitfires. But of course we did install cannons eventually, and which had been very much a point of our staff policy. But the early cannon installations in Spitfires were really unreliable. They had a sort of drum feed arrangement which didn't work very well, and several experimental versions were tried out, some of which were tried in 19 Squadron at Duxford, and but eventually Spitfire, of course, had two cannons and four machine guns, and then later on four cannons. As time went on, they got to a state of high degree of reliability, but they were terribly unreliable to begin with. Kept on stopping.
Now, Supermarine, being situated at Southampton, must have been very vulnerable during the German air raids.
Well, the Supermarines were severely bombed eventually, I think later on in September or October, and the factory was virtually destroyed. But before that happened, we had succeeded in dispersing a lot of the vital jigs and machine tools and so on, and the whole place was, the whole particularly after the bombing, the whole of Supermarines was dispersed over Hampshire, Dorset, and around Reading and that sort of thing, and it was a most the Spitfire production was temporarily interrupted after the bombing, but it soon got back into stride, and the firm, we took over all sorts of garages and disused laundry and goodness knows what all over the place, and the production was kept going. It was a remarkable achievement, actually. And then, of course, in the early part of 1940, the first Spitfires began to emerge from the Castle Bromwich factory, which were rather late getting going, but they eventually became, of course, the main source of supply, and later on in 1943 they were producing something like I think the total output of Spitfires from Castle Bromwich and the southern region, which was had been Supermarines and was then dispersed, as I say, the total national output of Spitfires became something like about 500 a month, I think, at one time. It was a remarkable achievement. And those, of course, were the later marks of Spitfire.
Can we come on now to the development of the Spitfire in its later marks? Because in 1941, there came the period when the offensive sweeps against occupied Europe were taking place. Can you tell me about how the new marks of Spitfire developed at that time?
Well, the first mark of Spitfire to be produced in any quantity for fighter command was the Mark V, which was the aircraft which had a new version of the Merlin called the Merlin 45, a good deal more powerful than the Merlins in the Battle of Britain. And also it developed its power at a higher level and so on. And the Mark V was quite a big step forward. But by 1940, the end of 41 or the beginning of 42, the FW-190 was appearing in the skies over France, and the fighter command squadrons which were doing these sweeps over northern France and over Belgium were getting a bad time, because the 190 had a greatly superior performance to the Mark V, which was what the fighter command was equipped with, and so a bad situation was arising. And then Rolls-Royce produced the Merlin 61 engine, which had a two-speed, two-stage supercharger, and it was had a marvelous produced a very great increase in power at high altitude, and we put that into Spitfire, and it became Spitfire Mark 9, which was a match for the 190, and it that restored the balance temporarily, and from then on it was rather a sort of ding-dong struggle between the developments of the 109 and the 190 on the German side, and developments of the Spitfire on the British side. And we always just about managed to keep one jump ahead, or more or less one jump ahead, or at least level. And the Mark 9 was a big step forward in June 1942, and then later on in 43 we then produced the Griffin Spitfire with the bigger Griffin. The Griffin engine was came from Rolls-Royce. It was a 37 litre engine as opposed to the Merlin, which was 27 litres, so it was a lot bigger capacity engine, and the same sort of supercharger developments which had been developed for the Merlin were applicable to the Griffin as well. And so we brought it gave another sort of lease of life, so to speak, to Spitfire. And one of the first Griffin engine Spitfires was the Mark 14, which was a very high performance airplane indeed, and that came out towards the end of 43, I think, and then later on this, and so it went. It was a sort of continual battle of wits, so to speak, between Rolls-Royce on the one hand and the German engine manufacturers on the other. And the Germans never had anything like the same amount of success in developing their engines that Rolls-Royce had. Rolls-Royce managed to somehow produce a sort of on a horses for courses basis, a sort of version of the Merlin or the Griffin, which was always just one jump ahead, I think.
Can you tell me the story of how you nearly lost your Mark 9 prototype by lending it to Harry Broadhurst on one occasion?
Oh, yes, well, I don't know, I nearly lost it, but when we had when I was flying the prototype Mark 9 at a place called Worthingdon, and I realised that it was a tremendous step forward, and so I happened to know Harry Broadhurst very well, who I'd known long before the war, who was then the station commander at Hornchurch, and I thought that it would be a good idea if he flew the Mark 9, and I knew, knowing Harry, I knew that he'd sort of put the word around in fighter command, particularly in at the Fighter Command headquarters that this thing was coming off. So I rang him up and said, would he like to fly it? He asked me to lunch, and I flew it up to Hornchurch. And after lunch, the Hornchurch wing was about to go off on a sweep that afternoon, and so we went and watched them take off, and then I handed over my old Mark 9 to him and brought in. He took off, and I went down to the hole, you know, the ops room, to watch the wing going across, and I noticed that there was one sort of individual plot just a little bit astern of the wing, and so I asked the controller who that was, and of course it turned out to be old Broadhurst, and so I was really worried because I knew that the aircraft had no ammunition in it and guns weren't loaded and so on, but anyhow, he was of course at very, very much greater height, and so he watched the wing go into action and then came back again, and as I expected, of course, the word was round Fighter Command in pretty short order. But that was just a sort of a little incident. It was.
But you had a few moments of anxiety.
Oh, I did, yes.
I think in July 1942, there was a race at Farnborough between you in a Spitfire, a Griffon Spitfire, and a Focke Wulf 190 and a Typhoon. Do you recollect that?
Yeah, yes, I do. It was... when you say it was a race, what happened was that they got a sort of fairly high-level audience down at Farnborough to watch a demonstration between a Typhoon on the one hand, an FW-190 which had been captured on the other hand, and a Spitfire which was to be rather taken as a sort of standard fighter of the day, and so I think I was just told to bring a Spitfire up for this thing, so I didn't instead of bringing an ordinary Spitfire, production Spitfire, I brought the prototype of the Griffon Spitfire, which had a great deal more power, of course, and Willie Wilson, who was the chief test pilot at Farnborough, had organised this thing, and so what we did was we took off the Typhoon flown by a chap from Hawkers called Seth Smith, and the FW-190 flown by Willie Wilson, and the Spitfire, the Griffon Spitfire, flown by me. And we got into line abreast at some suitable distance away from the airfield, somewhere over Odium, I think, and we started heading off back for Farnborough. And then at sort of due signal from Willie, we would all open our throttles simultaneously and virtually race for the airfield. And I think everybody expected that the Typhoon would... probably win the race, and that the FW-190 would come in perhaps second, or you know, it was really a race between a Typhoon and an FW-190, and the old Spitfire would be sort of coming in last. Well, actually, it of course happened the other way around. First of all, the 190 engine gave trouble, and so Willie had to drop out of the race, and as I expected, the Griffon Spitfire came in first, and the Typhoon came in second, and the FW-190 had more or less dropped out of the race. So that was certainly put the cat among the pigeons. This was in front of a very high-level audience, and including the CNC of Fighter Command, Sholto Douglas, and So that rather put the cat among the pigeons, and the next thing was that Sholto Douglas demanded that some of this. So this little Spitfire, which had the small Griffon engine, was we 100 was ordered straight away, and we produced 100, and it became the Mark 12, which was a very good little airplane. It was mostly used for fighter recce purposes, but it was a good little aircraft, and it was faster than the 190 at low level, but it required the bigger Griffon engine in the Mark 14 to beat the 190 at high level.
Do you remember Bill Lappin of Rolls Royce saying anything to you after that test?
Oh well, old Bill Lappin was there. Of course, he was at all these sort of things, and I think he thought I'd pulled a bit of a fast one, but which of course I had to some extent, and. But the fact was that the 190 was Spitfire 12 was faster than the Typhoon at low level. But of course, the Typhoon was a marvelous aeroplane because it carried such a heavy load of ordnance. I mean, the Typhoon was the best tank busting aeroplane on the Allied side at that time, and of course that was the role in which it was primarily used. It wasn't a very good fighter as such, because it hadn't got the performance, but it had a marvellous role armed with 6-inch RPs rockets, and it played havoc with the German tanks after D-Day.
Why was Lappin so annoyed?
Oh, I don't think he was annoyed at all. He was. I think that there was a little bit of a thing within Rolls-Royce. There was a slight sort of conflict within Rolls-Royce between the people who were trying to develop the Merlin and the people who were trying to develop the Griffon. And this happened to be a bit of a leg up for the Griffon school, of course. And I think that was all Bill Lappin was thinking about. He wasn't annoyed. I think he was quite amused, actually.
How did you come to join the Fleet Air Arm?
Oh, well, that was... We had to develop... We were asked to develop the Spitfire into a CFAR, a naval aircraft. And the fact of, you see, what the Navy had done, they'd really got their fighter policy really round the necks at one time before the war. They hadn't, they had no single-seater fighter of really high performance in the Navy, because they'd been, they had put their shirt on a thing called the Fuma, which was a two-seater. And they felt that you would have to have a two-seater because they needed a navigator. You see, I mean, flying large distances over the sea, I mean, if you haven't got some means of getting back to the ship, you're going to finish up in the drink. And that had to... Therefore, they felt it was absolutely necessary to always have a two-seater fighter and embodying a qualified navigator. Well, when the war started, of course, they found that ships in the Mediterranean were very vulnerable to attack by shore-based bombers, and they had a lot of losses as a result of that, and they therefore needed a high-performance single-seater, but they hadn't got any. So the only things that could do, had to be very quickly modified, a Hurricane, some Hurricanes and some Spitfires, to have arrestor hooks and to be able to operate off the deck. And we had to try and do that with the Spitfire. Well, the early experiences with the CIFAR, as it was called, where that were very unhappy because they were very difficult to land on the deck, and it's a deck landing had never been considered in the original design, and the CIFAR wasn't really robust enough. It was a very lightweight aircraft, and so there was a lot of trouble. And as a result of this, it was sometime in towards the end of 1942, I think, when the real trouble began. And there were a lot of meetings in the Admiralty, and I got involved in one or two of these meetings and sort of asked my views about the suitability of the aircraft for deck landing. So I said, well, it's no good asking me because I've never landed on a ship. I know nothing about naval operations, whatever. And after that meeting, I remember Admiral Boyd, who was the Fifth Sea Lord and therefore head of the Fleet Arum, he drew me aside and he said, how would you like to come into Fleet Arum for a bit and learn a bit about... So I said, oh yes, certainly I would. And so the next thing was I was found myself serving in the Fleet Arum, sort of disguised as a naval officer, and I learned a very great deal. I did a lot of deck landing and on various types of aircraft, including CIFARs, and my remit really was to write a report for Admiral Boyd, which was sort of setting out the various steps which would need to be taken, particularly in the training of pilots, to make them to improve the situation with the CIFAR, which I did. But I had about 5 or 6 months serving in various carriers and learned a great deal, enjoyed it very much.
But you didn't see any combat in the Fleet Arum?
No. I served in a naval fighter squadron for a time on board ship, and we didn't actually have any actual combat, but we were working up for the South of France landing, I remember. So I had a great deal of experience of the, and of course operating almost entirely off the little Woolworth carriers, as they were known, because they were very small, of course, so I did learn a great deal about naval operations, I think, at that time.
What was the spiteful?
Spiteful was an aircraft which had a new wing, a completely redesigned wing. And the reason for that was that, you see, when the Spitfire wing was never really tested very much in the wind tunnel, and therefore all its sort of drag characteristics and the prediction of its drag characteristics as it went into a higher and higher speed were entirely theoretical. And there wasn't any real sort of... There were no supersonic wind tunnels or anything in those days. And so we decided... I think it was decided in about 1941 or something, when they were... We knew what the Rolls-Royce were predicting in the way of the increases in power that would be produced during 42, 43, 44, and 45, and so on. And our aerodynamicist realized that Rolls-Royce were going to be producing so much power out of some of their future engines that the Spitfire would not be able to use it, because the Spitfire wing would be running into its into a very sharp turn up in its drag curve, and eventually we might get into a situation where the Spitfire was acting as a sort of brake. The Rolls-Royce would be producing an amount of thrust which we couldn't use. And so it was decided we have to have a new wing. Therefore, a new laminar flow wing was designed in conjunction with the National Physical Laboratory at Teddington, the NPL, and it was our aerodynamicists and the NPL aerodynamicists got together. This was in, I suppose, during 42, and designed a very beautiful low-drag laminar flow wing of complete, instead of the sort of elliptical shape at the spin, it was a straight taper, a very neat little wing, beautifully engineered. And we built these wings and put them on the Spitfire 14, which had was the highest performance Spitfire in production at that time. And we tried it out. Well, in fact, the drag of this this wing was called the Spiteful Wing, was rather disappointing. We didn't get as much speed out of it as we had hoped. And in fact, in other words, it was discovered that the drag characteristics of the standard Spitfire wing, when you got into the high subsonic regions, was a lot better than had been predicted. And the Spiteful wing was not quite so good as had been predicted. So, in fact, the two sort of, if you can see what I mean. And the Spiteful we put a new fuselage in it because there was quite a lot of scope for improving the Spitfire fuselage, and we altered the shape of the thing, we have better view over the nose for deflection shooting and so on, and better cockpit and so on, and this produced this little airplane called the Spiteful. Well, by the time the Spiteful came out in production, the war was nearly over, and it was not such a good airplane as we had hoped. There were certain snags about it, which would have been all been sorted out in due course, but we couldn't. There wasn't in time, and so it was cancelled. But that was the reason for it. In other words, the Spiteful failed because it was not quite such an improvement over the Spitfire as had been hoped, and the Spitfire was a lot better than had been expected at the high subsonic speeds.
Did the Spitfire ever become a jet plane?
No, but we used a Spiteful wing with a new fuselage for a jet aircraft, which was called the Attacker, and we built that after the war, and we produced it for the Navy because they were